It's one thing to tell people, this is my nickname and I gave it to you, versus this is what everyone calls me because it's fun. There's a story behind it. When you're building your reputation equity, if you are well-intended but unintentionally aware, unaware that you're pushing your narrative towards me, I pick up on that. And I say, well, then just don't talk and let your actions speak. Let your delivery speak to your quality, your credit. And that's where the reputation begins, versus you're telling me your reputation. I either believe you or I don't believe you. And that's a very dangerous space.
Welcome to Object Subject Form, a series of conversations exploring the human side of creativity at the evolving intersection of art, technology, and finance. Today, I'll be having a conversation with my dear friend and creative thought leader, Ricardo Crespo. Although he doesn't like to identify with titles, I have to give him credit where credit's due. Prior to joining Studio 13, Ricardo held positions as Global Creative Chief at 20th Century Fox, Global Creative Chief at Mattel, and Executive Creative Director at McLaren McCann. He is often sought out by many international brands and currently functions as Branding and Marketing Strategy Advisor to C-suite executives across Nike, Apple, and Beats by Dre, and is engaged as a Specialist Executive Creative Advisor to the US Soccer Federation. Today, we will explore the concept of reputation equity and how Ricardo earned trust in building and leading creative excellence with cross-functional teams across a diverse range of high-profile global brands and initiatives. Ricardo, thank you for being so generous with your time today. I always feel very lucky to have the opportunity to sit down with you and share ideas over some crab fried rice. And you often drop what I like to call nuggets of wisdom. And I always leave our conversations wishing other people could have had a seat at the table. So with that said, I'd like to focus our conversation on the theme of reputation equity. And it's something you mentioned to me over 6 to 8 years ago and has always stayed with me with tremendous impact in every aspect of my life, be it with clients, friends, colleagues, my relationships. But before that, please share who Ricardo is and what's inspiring you in life and your creative journey.
Simon, thank you. Thank you again, multiple times over. It's a pleasure. For this session in particular, it's fun because to your point, yeah, we always share a meal, which incidentally to me is a muse for us. It's a catalyst of some sort for us to start these idea sessions. Humbled and privileged to be here. Thank you for creating this time to share, and absolutely would love to expand more on this philosophy of reputation equity that's guided my personal journey. Just a quick little boring background context. Professional creative, literally, that's the word I describe versus reciting a title. Multidisciplinary, 25 plus years in the business, and formally trained designer. And to your point, Simon, I believe to this day, for the most part, well-intended, most design curriculum and syllabus in these programs are well-intended and predominantly focused on what I call the soft skills, what you and I discussed, the soft skills of creativity, which is the software, the pushing pixels, if you will. Those are hard skills. And then the soft skills, which are opportunistic for us, is the leadership. How do you become a more improved, progressively better creative? And some of those cues are emotional intelligence, cultivating influence and understanding how that when you moved and you graduate through these tiers as a professional, that it isn't so much graduating to tiers of higher titles and higher pay, it's higher accountability and higher influence. That's the way that I see it. And reputation equity, to your prompt, was something that we shared 6 years ago. And I remember it prompted a conversation that we shared over the years, over and over again. It's something that I adopted, Simon, many years ago. And I never meant to coin the phrase, the two words, as if I was going to sell a book one day or give a TED talk. I've spoken about it to many private audiences, but for our friends today in the industry, reputation equity is an applied philosophy that I recognize and I adopted myself to realize that this is what I need to do. This is what guides my very progression every day. To this day, tomorrow, what'll happen tomorrow one of the many personal philosophies that I live by. But the two words, reputation, equity, was really just the genesis of understanding what each word was provoking and ultimately prompting. Reputation, the first word, and its most simple form is, how do people speak about you when you're not in the room? And more specifically, how are you endorsed when you're not in the room? It's one thing to say who you are and what you can do, but it's a whole other thing when someone can speak about you. And when you have multiple people who have never met each other and speak positively, consistently about you, that's really reputation. That's positive reputation. The equity portion that comes very close to that is the notion of value. It's much like people have equity in their homes, people have equity in their careers. What is the value that you consistently bring into any engagement, any experience, any interaction, right? An assignment, a project, a campaign, a collaboration with somebody. So reputation equity is, how do people speak about you when you're not in the room? How do they speak about you consistently? How do they endorse you in the most positive light consistently? And then that endorsement is always with this exclamation point of, yeah, if I had the chance to do it again, we'd bring him back or we'd bring her back. That's reputation equity to me. It served me well as a guiding, it's my North Star, Simon, as I continue to traverse my career.
So what you're actually trying to say is, we shouldn't try to force our narrative in the room onto other people of how we want people to perceive us.
Exactly. Yeah. And Simon, the loose description of that is, again, I go back to this crazy description of a nickname. It's one thing to tell people, this is my nickname and I gave it to you, versus this is what everyone calls me because it's fun. There's a story behind it. When you're building your reputation equity, if you are well-intended but unintentionally aware, unaware that you're pushing your narrative towards me, I pick up on that. And I say, well, then just don't talk and let your actions speak. Let your delivery speak to your quality, your credit. And that's where the reputation begins, versus you're telling me your reputation. I either believe you or I don't believe you. And that's a very dangerous space.
Yeah. And it doesn't come across as being sincere.
Right. Yeah. And someone can sense that very clearly. It's called dissonance. And like in music, you can, like that tune, where did it come from? I heard it and it didn't fit. And people are keen on that.
When did you first realize the importance of reputation? And was there an experience that defined this for you? Or is it just something that you've always lived by? Or was there a turning point for you?
Yeah, no, actually very relevant. And thank you, Simon, for asking. I wish I could tell you that's always been it's in my DNA. I'm not going to lie. It's not. Nobody knows that. I never knew that. But there was something. There was a catalyst. There was a moment in my career where, you know, what I called the proverbial, you can't look in the mirror and bullshit yourself, because you can't lie to the person in the mirror. And I had that moment. It was just like that epiphany. And I'll tell you, I was working at the ad agency, and young, arrogant, stupid, don't know any better. You know, you think you own the world. And that not justified and not validated, but I had this incredibly fortunate streak of always closing. And I it's like Mad Men, bring Rick in and he'll close the deal and we'll get the account and we'll do this. And after a while you get punch drunk, what I call, you drink your own Kool-Aid, or you don't think your shit stinks. But the truth of the matter is, you get on this roll, but you need that moment, that level sets that recalibrates everything. And that's what I had that triggered the very genesis of this concept of reputation equity. And I remember I was brought in, I was working on a campaign, and essentially, to put it in short form, I was at the final presentation of this opportunity, where I was asking the CMO of a very large automotive company for ostensibly $2.5 million to shoot a campaign to launch a new vehicle that they're introducing into their line. And the arrogant young whippersnapper, can't take me down mentality of this arrogant Ricardo. And I look back and I laugh now, never again, I'm ever going to be that way. It was this wonderful blessing in disguise. And I remember Susan was her name, the client. Susan was very accommodating. And that's where I realized that she just embodied emotional intelligence, because what she did, and I'll expand on this, Simon, she allowed me to save face in that moment, but she knew that I was just spinning. I was spinning. And so the presentation starts, and I do what I do best. I'm doing the dog and pony, and I'm sounding like a very smart creative out of Mad Men, and dramatic pauses, pitching, hand waving, pause here, making eye contact here. And I thought, oh, I got it. This is it. 20 minutes later, utter silence. And she just leans across the table, looks at me. She says, "That was amazing. I don't understand a fucking word you said in the last 20 minutes." And as a creative, you're thinking, that was my best word. What do you mean? You didn't understand it. And I defaulted into this, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm a professional. You don't know what you're talking about. You're a marketer. You're a brand guy. You're a client. You don't know. But what I realized what she was saying was absolutely dead on. And I was so mad at her. And what this woman did, what Susan did, was so clever. She said, "I believe that there is some potential in what you're saying to me. So here's what I'd like to do. I'm going to come back tomorrow at 9 o'clock and we're going to do this again. And I'd love for you to present your ideas again." And I got to tell you, when she left the room, I left the agency and went back home and I was thinking, what do they know? Clients, what do they know? And I was so mad. I was displacing all of this sense of I'm missing the mark on someone else. And the first thing I realized was, man, you're passing accountability off to someone else. You're using a situational environment to say it's their fault. They didn't get it. And that's when that first phrase in my mind, Simon, of you can't lie to the person in the mirror. Why bother? It's just you in the mirror. Why bother? And I realized, you know what? She's absolutely right. I spoke like an ad guy or a design guy. I used the right words that sounded like I was describing these things. But what she really was looking for was, what is the connection of my ability to a client, her end consumer, that she wants to enable so that I can go shoot this commercial and ostensibly sell this vehicle? But I didn't present that. What I presented was how I wanted my work to be accepted by her and her firm and in this big automotive company. And as soon as I hit that epiphany, it was about midnight, and I realized it's not her, it's me. I recalibrated my whole thinking. And when I went in the next day, I did not show one piece of creative. I presented the exact same thing, but I did not show creative. I just spoke about a story, and the story how this young woman would find this vehicle, and it would resonate with why this vehicle was an extension of her choices, her living, her lifestyle, and that this vehicle should be part of her lifestyle, and she wants to acquire it because it's an expression of her choices. And when that cadence changed the next morning, the light bulb went on about, okay, this is what it means to move from being a creative designer to a creative leader. It was the ability to engage somebody into a story, but then make sure that story resonated with the person across the table you're trying to talk to versus trying to sell it to them. When you bring them into the story, they feel they're part of the story. And that was incredibly powerful. And I got to tell you, Simon, I got punched drunk. Then I realized, how do I do that again? How do I do that again? And she said something to me that day. Susan said something to me that morning. She said, "That's what I was looking for. That's what I was looking for." And she leaned across the table and says, you can do this. You're confident you can do this. You can move the needle with this new model that we're going to introduce." "Yes, Susan, I think I can. I think we will. I'm absolutely." She goes, "I'll give you an extra million. I want you to shoot 2 spots.
Wow.
And I want you to do what you said you were going to do." I'm super fortunate. We shot 2 spots. Through the roof, successful. But the biggest takeaway for me wasn't that we won the account or we won that piece of business, was that she became something to me that I didn't expect, that I didn't realize I needed nor wanted, was somebody called me on my bullshit right then and there. And I had that split second to decide, am I going to dismiss this and say, "Yo, you don't know what you're talking about?" Or am I just really going to take the hurt away, just take it, you know, take it like a cowboy, if you will, and just go, "You know, there's some validity to what you said." And that, Simon, is what triggered this concept. I didn't know the right words at that particular time. This was earlier part of my career, middle part of my career. I didn't realize I would coin it as reputation equity. But what she said that morning was, "I'm going to give you the extra million because I believe that you're going to do this." And that was the beginning of how she projected a sense of endorsement of me to say, "I trust that you're going to do what you have with this. So I'm endorsing you to do this." I remember the next morning, our chief creative officer at that agency came into my office that day. She said, "Yeah, Susan called and said she wasn't gonna go with this campaign, and she was gonna assign it to another creative team. But for some reason, you pulled through at the last minute." And she basically said that you understood the business. You understood the business of what she's trying to do versus you presented the creative around the business. And that perfect meld, Simon, of the business of creative and the creative business coming together in that one moment was what I was able to effectively do. And I just became so enamored. I said, how do I repeat this? How do I repeat this? But that endorsement that she gave to my CCO at that point was an opportunity to keep doing that. And that's the value I associated, because I brought value to that relationship with Susan and the client, but I brought value to the reputation of the agency, of McCann. And that was the, I guess, the genesis of how these two words formed to be. But how she spoke about me when I wasn't in the room, long after I'd gone, when she spoke to my supervisor, my CCO, said, he's going to get an extra million.
Which it sounds like a very difficult moment being a young creative, because you could have very easily let your ego get in the way or try to redo your presentation or redo the formula, let's say.
Sorry, mate, but that's exactly what happened. I did let my ego get in the way. And it wasn't until midnight that night where my bullshit was called in front of me that I said, you know what? As a professional, put your ego aside. Just listen to what she's offering. She wasn't offering criticism. What she was offering was a very, very tangible piece of feedback, which was, I hear what you're saying. I don't understand what you're saying. Not, I don't like what you're saying. I don't understand. And that hit home. That hit home because it had nothing to do with my ego. It had nothing to do with trying to defend my craft. What it was somebody telling me, if you don't understand it, it's my accountability that I'm not communicating it effectively. And that reframed, recalibrated my approach. So from 1 a.m. till 7 a.m., I was redoing everything. And I didn't touch the creative, as I mentioned. I didn't touch the creative. I just reframed how I was going to bring her into a story. At the very beginning, I didn't bring her into a story. I told the story, and then she was at the end of it. But the next morning, I started the story with her. But then I revealed at the end of that story, you, Susan, are this person who's going to buy this car. And that, I think, Simon, was the catalyst that reframed it. And that endorsement was born out of that. And then the value, that reputation equity combination was the genesis of this philosophy that I adopted inside my mind's eye.
And what inputs would you say kind of come together or culminate to influence one's reputation? I mean, at 12 o'clock midnight, you made a decision to put everything aside, put your ego aside, and reframe and tell the story of the creative and not necessarily change it, as you said.
Yep.
What other inputs do you feel can affect and influence one's reputation in their creative journey?
Yep. Great question. And the first and most important response to that is the discipline of removing yourself out of that reputation. So to me, the discipline of removing yourself out of that is the ego. And that's a key consideration. I call an attribute as many components. And that attribute is removing your ego, removing your selfish tie-in to validate the work that you've created and you're presenting, but removing yourself and then replacing that point of view with your audience. And in this particular case, I managed two audiences in that story, was the person, the client who was going to enable the storytelling, and then to whom the story was being told, which is the end consumer who's ultimately going to buy this vehicle. But reframing it so that it's not about me and it's all about who this is being told to is an incredible attribute to cultivate and understand. And that's the power of storytelling, right? Is bringing somebody into the story. And even though they're not an active participant, they're not a character in the story, it resonates with them because they almost feel like, I've just met you, but why do I feel like you've been in my head for the last 6 months and I'm part of the story? And that was one of the insights that I learned as well. But maintaining that, remove yourself out of the situation, understand who your audience is. What I call reading the room, Simon. You know, constantly read the room. Understand people's poker tells, you know, much like the game of poker. You can always tell when somebody's bluffing when you've mastered that idea.
Which is a very hard thing to do, I think, for people to put themselves in other people's shoes and really understand what somebody is trying to communicate to you. Because so often we are thinking about what we're going to say next, what's a priority to us, and we don't often remove ourselves from feedback, from conversation, to actually hear the other person. And so I think that was a really good skill. I mean, we could do an episode on that at some point. But I this was a turning point for you. This was something that you observed about yourself.
Yes.
Has there been any positive or negative experiences you've had that you could share that you've actually observed in others, in other business practices that perhaps stuck in your mind from your career?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the same premise, Simon, which is when you look at a situation, you look at the environment of that situation, was somebody, although well-intended, was somebody so immersed in their own narrative? And not to sound so ethereal about it, that example, that case study I just shared with you with Susan, in that first day, I was in my narrative only because I'd rehearsed it. And again, it's well-intended. That's all I knew. That's what I was really good at. So it was my narrative that I was pushing. The second morning, it wasn't my narrative or her narrative. It was the who we want to sell this vehicle to. And then when I brought that narrative and I brought her, Susan, in that narrative to understand that she had the ability to enable and make this story come to life, that is a perfect example. And to your question, yeah, I've actually observed some other situations where I had the good fortune to come into organizations like Nike and some professional sports teams and various different high-profile assignments where I've seen the incumbent creatives fall into that same trap. And again, I always want to give the benefit of the doubt. They're well-intended, but their narrative is influenced subconsciously by, I feel like I got to show my worth today because this is what I'm being paid and my business card says this and this is the same company I'm in with the CMO that I'm sitting across the table. And so I've seen, without sending in a particular situation, that the consistency of people not being able to come out of beyond their own narrative, which is what I need to sell or pitch today. What you need to communicate today is very different from what you need to pitch today. What you need to communicate today is what resonates with the person across the table and what ultimately resonates to why they're enabling something. But if you don't remove yourself from that and it's your narrative, you're going to go down that rabbit hole all the time. Landmines, as you've shared the words with me. You fall into landmines unintentionally, but you're there. And then what happens when you fall into a rabbit hole or a landmine, you're backpedaling. And in your best of intent to backpedal, you're actually digging a deeper hole because you've removed yourself from the bigger story of what you're trying to communicate. You're trying to recoup your reputation. You're trying to reestablish your validity and your expertise as a subject matter expert.
And you often see this with companies or departments where they could have the best creative in the world. The company could have the best creative output in the world. But if the reputation of CEO, owner is not great, in my opinion, I don't feel like it's sustainable. And it's not sustainable because, you know, you can hire the best talent, but you could have a revolving door. Mm-hmm. You could create the best work and output the most amazing commercials, whatever it might be, but if you don't have a good reputation with your clients, again, it's not sustainable.
Right. Simon, and I would argue if you don't carry consistent positive reputation with your colleagues, with your peers, with your immediate environment, which is your studio, your agency, that is also a huge influence on that ability. And to add to that, there's this notion of reputation equity, right? We spoke about this. How do people speak consistently positively about you? That's the endorsement. And then the value, reputation equity. The next key attribute to that is how effectively can you port that to new situations? And that was what I learned, Simon, is with that situation from Susan. And then when I decided to go client side, that locked into my brain. And the ability to port that reputation equity and those practices, those attributes, I can port them into a new environment where nobody knew who I was and I could reset. But I didn't have to reset. I was influencing my workflow, my thinking methodology so that I was seeding the idea of my reputation equity without actually putting my name on it or stamping my name on it. And the ability to port reputation equity from within your environment, your agency, your studio, to new situations, if you move studios, new assignments, new career paths. Generating and cultivating your reputation equity is only as good as your ability to port it. Because if you'd never leave the biggest pond that you're in, that's the value. That's when you really have equity in the industry, is when you can port that equity from new agency, new studio, new environments to the next, and your reputation, your endorsements precede you and carry that. That's very powerful to cultivate.
And I remember when we first met, you made it clear that the way you often get opportunities, you know, receive opportunities from clients that perhaps you're still working with today, is word of mouth.
Yes.
It's not, you know, posting your resume. In fact, it was very difficult to find you online a few years ago. I see now that, you have a little bit more of a presence than you did when we first met, but there was this air about you that was like a ninja. and it was very hard to find you, but you consistently were creating and you consistently had work, and you explained to me that this was through the reputation that you've managed to curate throughout, you know, your entire career.
Yeah, curate and is an immense amount of discipline to always increase, grow, earn your reputation equity. And I remember when we had that conversation, and it's a human truth. 99% of people's, it's just the way that we are as human beings. Psychologically, it's a human truth. 99% of people who didn't understand, and I didn't expect them to, you know, Ricardo, how come we can't find you anywhere? How come I can't see your work? Where's your book? Where's your reel? Where's all of this? And I made a conscious decision not to do that. And my experience with that, and no one has to agree with me, it was my personal experience, was that I can publish a website today, tomorrow, and I can put work up there. At the end of the day, Simon, you viewing that website is purely subjective. You're looking at an image, you're looking at a reel, and you're saying, this was the talent, this was the challenge, here's the task, and here's what this reel executed against that challenging task. At the end of the day, no one has full context of it. So whether they like it or not, or understand it or not, is purely subjective. And what I didn't want to do was win or lose business or the opportunity to engage based on subjectivity. And so the conscious decision to be a ninja, zero footprint, really reinforced why I believed in reputation equity, because I felt that if I continue to earn this reputation, I continue to deliver value, those people with which I just left that value and their endorsements, they'll pass my phone number to the next person. The strategic side of me was I channeled when that person was going to receive my phone number. Don't get me wrong. There's a strategy side of me that I knew when I wanted to get that. But the power of somebody saying, this is Ricardo, to the next opportunity without me saying, I'm Ricardo and trust me, is inherently different, because that endorsement is real. And when that person would get it, I'm very fortunate to this day. My phone number gets passed from one CEO to the next CEO, and I get invited to conversations, and I start potential journeys through those conversations. And 9 times out of 10, saying, we never thought you were going to go there. How do you know so much about our business? Well, I prepared. I wanted to show respect. But reputation equity and not having to self-promote are two things as a practice that I've adopted, that I apply every day. And you know this very quirkily, that if I call you on my phone, it shows unknown and
no caller ID.
No caller ID. And that's part of the whole strategy, right? But most people, and I said 99% of the people, think, well, what are you hiding? What are you evading? Like, are you a criminal? Why don't you show your book? And I said, but that's the strategy. I'm the 1% because everyone else does this. I go left when everyone goes right. And I do that by design. And may not work for everybody. It's worked for me. It's worked for me. That's all I can say. And it's by design. It's the strategist in me that understands if I have and I continue to cultivate positive experience, and that positive experience is an endorsement, and there's a value station to that endorsement, that's reputation equity. People will speak about me positively. That will open up opportunities for me. And I've enjoyed that for the last 10 years.
So it seems like you spend a lot of time consciously or subconsciously thinking about ways to maintain and continue earning your own reputation equity. So is there any tips that you could give to other creatives listening to this episode to enhance their reputation and earn reputation equity as a designer, an art director, creative director at various stages of career, even though, as we discussed earlier, you know, a lot of your early stages of career outside of, you know, when you've graduated from college and, you know, you come out of your art degree program, you generally are trying to get your skills as sharp as possible. But even as a young creative beginning their career.
Yeah. No, again, this is that perfect hindsight is 2020. If I could, you know, this is the quintessential question. If you could go back 20 years and tell yourself this, I wouldn't know to say it was called reputation equity, but for, you know, for our friends listening today, yeah, that if, you know, what I would recommend is first understand the principle of the philosophy of reputation equity. It's a principle and philosophy simultaneously. And then I would encourage anyone listening and even ourselves, Simon, I practice this every day, is adopt certain attributes that allow you to consistently apply that philosophy. So many attributes, but I'll tell you the three key things is remove your ego, humility, always learning. There's always ability for you to progress. Kaizen is another philosophy of mine. Rolling stone gathers no moss. Right? I have a tattoo on my back. It's there for a reason. I can't see it. I don't need to see it. But the tattoo is kanji that says continual improvement. I don't need to see it. It's behind me because I'm always ahead of improvement. So it's a little brain teaser there, but I use that. So humility, leave your ego at the door. The second thing I mentioned is when you leave your ego at the door, understand that it isn't about your narrative that you're trying to show. You shouldn't have to prove your value every day. Your value is reinforced when you give and you deliver positive experience. That's the endorsement, right? So don't write your own book every day. You've written your book. How do you refine it? How do you take 18 pages and make them 9, make them 6, make them 4, make them 3, so that in one page, that's what someone's endorsing about you. So leave your ego at the door. Understand someone else's narrative. And then the third key thing that I say is always in my top three is attributes that reinforce this applied philosophy of reputation equity is be the dumbest person in the room. 25 plus years, I could have an egotistical stance like, you know what, Simon, trust me on this. I know what I'm doing. It's very easy for me to say that. But if I'm outside looking at myself, like how arrogant, who the fuck are you that you can say, trust me? When someone else says trust him, that's very powerful, right? So the idea there is leave your ego at the door, understand the other person's narrative. Why will it resonate with them? And third, make sure that you're the dumbest person in the room, which means surround yourself with people that are 10 times smarter than you. They don't have to have a higher title than you. Surround yourself with people who think differently than you and study why they think differently. That's how you raise your game. I remember as a young athlete, I was intimidated to drop in on a half pipe that were people 10 times better than me. Today, I'm a mixed martial artist. I was always hesitant to get into a ring with somebody 10 times better than me. But you know what happens? It's true. It's another human truth. If you put yourself at a level where there are people higher than you or more experienced than you, your game will go up. It's just a natural way of life. Your game will go up when you surround yourself with smarter people, better people. So find those people. And never have the arrogance to go, I'm always the one, the smartest one in the room. No way, man. No way. Surround yourself with people that push you out of your comfort zone, that make you challenge your own status quo, right? And that goes back to checking your own ego. If you are drinking your own Kool-Aid, you will never have the opportunity to go, there's somebody smarter than the room. Do you know how many times I have studied 9 and 10-year-olds in a room? When I sometimes I teach a kid's class just as a pro bono martial arts class, and 9 to 10-year-olds they don't have the masterful technique as experienced practitioners like my friends and I do. But what 9 and 10-year-olds do that is clearly in a room is when one of them is not doing the discipline of the practice, that influence is bad influence, and everyone likes that. So that's a learning moment. People follow influence; they don't follow titles. 9 and 10-year-olds don't have titles. Simon, it's the exact same way in our professional business world. You can have the highest title, and I love you to death, and I congratulate you. But if you're not producing and executing in that title consistently, that means you're living behind your title versus delivering on the accountability of your title. two very different things. If your title is preceding you and that's how you want to gain your reputation equity, I challenge you to port that to the next assignment because it'll never happen. But if you understand how your influence positively engenders trust and brings people to want to hear why you have thoughts to share and why you have proposals for consideration, that's thought leadership. That's executive creative leadership. It's not because my title is three words long. It's because this is what I understand, and this is what I understand we have an opportunity to do. So may I suggest this? Just reframing it that way is showing emotional intelligence as a creative leader, as any leader, because people follow influence. They don't follow titles.
It's the journey opposed to the title.
Absolutely.
As well. I remember being in Malaysia many, many years ago, and I was at a friend's Taekwondo black. He was going for his black mm-hmm. belt.
Yep.
What do you call that when you're going for your belt? Is there a specific name?
Oh, different arts, different cultures have them. But yeah, you're basically you're graduating to the next tier.
Yeah, your graduation. Yeah. And I remember the first thing he said to everybody that was about to go through their testing was, listen, I don't want any of you to be disappointed about the fact that you may not receive the belt, because it's not about the belt. He said, I want you to disregard that right now. That's like the icing on the cake. It's about the journey and how you perform today and what you learn. And I always think about surrounding yourself with people that will just call out things like that, mm-hmm. that will, you know, sometimes if you're, you know, you're running a race or you're trying to get a new job and fight for the title, it's not about that. It's about how you perform on a daily basis or, you know, as a whole. And seeking, to your point, seeking advice vertically upwards, to me, is so much more valuable than seeking laterally. And if you surround yourself with five or six people, if possible, that are, again, to your point, smarter than you, more experienced than you, they may not even be older than you, but they may have more experience in life, in what you're trying to achieve. And
sir,
you
Simon,
become
I have to enjoy.
That.
So there's a key aspect to that. You would argue that smarter than me, what's the definition of smarter than me? My definition when I say surround yourself with people smarter than you are, it doesn't mean they have a bigger title. Smarter than me means, are they provoking me to get out of my comfort zone? Mm-hmm. Are they thinking in a way that I'm not used to? That to me is smarter. It's not so much that they have a bigger title or they've written seven books. It's the people who don't have those accolades that are the most wise, in my opinion, right? Let me reach here for a second. Have you ever watched somebody in a trade craft just do what they do? I remember watching a plumber come in to work on my house and fix this plumbing situation. And just watching, and we as a society were thinking, oh, blue collar, white collar plumber. No. I was in awe watching this person, just their trade craft. And the satisfaction of them knowing from years of experience, like, my God, that's why they're a professional. Look what they did in 5 minutes that most people would never be able to do. But most people don't see that. They don't think them as the smartest people in the room. But I'm the opposite. I don't need a title. My God, what did I learn from that opportunity? Is that person didn't look what to fix it. They looked around and go, this is what's causing the problem. And most people go, here's how I'm going to fix it. And some of the times you have to look at it and go, what's causing the problem? I need to fix that, not where we're at.
Exactly.
Right. And that to me, Simon, so just to jump in and interject, was that someone would always ask me, well, how do you know when somebody's smarter than you? It's not a title. It's not they make more money. It's not they're older. It's do they provoke you to think differently? Do they provoke you to come out of a comfort zone that you're always defaulting to? And when you're not in a comfort zone, just by natural order, you're progressing. You're going into new territory, and embrace that.
Wise words, my friend.
Yeah. Embrace it. It's so rewarding. It's tough, but it's so rewarding. Yeah.
And thank you so much for sharing this wisdom. Hopefully we've, you know, got an even more, I mean, I definitely have more understanding of the topic of reputation equity, how to apply it in your career, how to think about reputation alongside your skill sets as a creative. What's next for Ricardo? I mean, it's very hard to find you. So I don't think there's going to be any posts lingering around LinkedIn or Twitter. But what's next for Ricardo in your journey? I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, no, I love that question. There's going to be more of this, I hope, Simon. I'd love to come back. I'm not so secretive per se in the sense of I'm hiding. I am more anonymous by design, by the practice of my profession, but I'm not anonymous in the desire to share. By the same token that if I have the wonderful fortune to be identified potentially as somebody who can provoke someone else, I'll happily come back and share more ideas. So what's next for me, honestly, it's a simple answer. It's I'm going to continue to progress. I'm going to continue to live this tattoo on my shoulder blades behind me. I don't need to see it. I know what it means to progress. And we are at this incredibly influential age of where technology and creativity is mixing. And I'm honestly very afraid, mate, of where we are, where the technology is so good that we could technically go call somebody and they'll give us 17 logos for $30 in 30 minutes. That's pushing pixels. There's no design thinking. It's delivering so many variants in this amount of time for this amount of dollars. Hone, if I could share something to our friends in the business, hone your ability to think like a designer, as a creative. And I always say this, I would love for you to show me right now, for the people who are listening to this, they can't see this, but Simon's got his laptop in front of him. Simon, please show me the magic button on there, which says design now and make me $1 million from this campaign or this design. And the reason that button doesn't exist is that we are in this influx of technology so readily available. And our next generation of creatives coming up in the business are really, really proficient in the craft of pushing pixels, the creative craft, but they have a much opportunity to learn the business of creativity. And that's reputation equity. It's understanding influence, understanding leadership, understanding leading without having to lead, understanding leading without me being told to lead, right? And understanding accountability. So I'm a big proponent as we move to the next stages of how can I contribute to the next generation of creatives that we're going to, in a way, we're going to work for them, yep. Right? We're going to work for them. So how do we keep them so that we're cultivating their holistic skill set, not just to being able to push pixels and be the best copywriter, the best motion designer, right? How do you tell stories? How do you engage somebody? And sometimes academies and very, very prestigious design programs and syllabus are very good and very prolific in their ability to teach the hard skills, pushing pixels, this software, that software. How do you make it faster? How do you get there faster instead of 7 layers, 3 layers? How do you do this? But where are we encouraging people to think creatively? Design starts up here. And for those people listening, I'm pointing to my brain. Design starts up here. The computer only does what we tell it to do. So there's no button on the computer that says design now, right? And my fear is that we are on the very precipice of creativity and design becoming a commodity. And it's up to us to decommoditize that by being influential leaders in how we think and how we present. Right? We're forever going to have clients that are marketers and they were going to say, I just want it blue. Why do you want it blue? What if blue was never part of why you wanted to do that? And our ability to present how somebody on that side of the table thinks differently, and that we presented green as opposed to blue, that's creative leadership.
Right, and we're very much on that precipice as you're talking about because of the introduction of AI.
Yep.
But as you said, it needs inputs, but it's going to be very interesting in the next few years. This is only the beginning about where that goes.
Yeah. Creativity, Simon, at its core is exactly that. It's the individual's ability to manifest that creativity. Once it's manifested, it is the tactical, which is the pushing the pixels, which is the motion design. But the creativity is something that each of us have to take accountability and adopt. And that's what's next for me, is to continue this discipline, to continue to hone it, to continue to never be comfortable, to continue to find lessons and learnings that I didn't expect and just stop in my tracks and go, what's happening there right now? That excites me in this business. Yeah. It's not about what new title I can get. That's exactly why I'm anonymous. I don't care what title you think I am. You know what matters? When I speak, when I act, when I deliver, that the experience will show.
Ricardo, thank you so much for your insight. I feel like we definitely went under the hood today with various topics. Just before we go, I do have one question that I ask all of my guests. I think it's an important one. What does it mean once you become a professional creative?
Yeah, I love that question. It can be loaded, but it can also be distilled down to simple principles, Simon. One consideration on how to approach that conversation is first acknowledging that by definition, a professional creative is one that has graduated from a formal training program, and the very next day, when they're working in the business, they're a professional creative. And the variances between how the attributes of that professional creative is directly correlated to where they are in their journey. So professional creative, when they are with the accountability / title of an executive creative director, is very different from the experiences and the knowledge base of somebody who's a professional creative fresh out of school. And I think that's a very interesting concept to consider, because everyone wants to hit the ground running. I'm a professional now. I'm being paid. That's exactly what it means to be a professional creative. I'm being compensated for this discipline of which I've received a diploma, and it says I'm a professional in this space. New, excited, eager professional creatives coming into our craft are always driven by the idea of making immediate impact. And they want to progress through the tiers of professional creativity. I want to be an art director tomorrow. Then I want to be a creative director. And I think that's incredibly important, because it's the drive and the inspiration of which somebody wants to follow that journey. It is those triggers, however, that helps us to understand that throughout that journey, it's absolutely okay to understand that at this stage in my journey as a professional creative, this is where I need to hone my skills. This is where I need to thrive. And it's okay. It's okay that I don't know what I don't know yet. And it's through no fault of that person's journey at that stage in their career. And I've always found that as you progress in your career from a junior designer, you know, fresh out of school, if you will, to an art director, senior designer, whatever allocation, whatever title you want to identify. But the system is that you're continually progressing. You're climbing the ladder, if you will. You're moving across tiers. Is that I've found that as you move across tiers and you have more experience, you communicate more effectively. There's more brevity. There's more value with less talk. With younger in the business, you want to sound smart. And in some cases, sounding smart is what exactly commoditizes our business. And clients don't recognize us as tiers because they're not in our craft. They don't know our business, right? They see things like you're a senior partner at the law firm or you're a junior associate at the law firm. They understand those concepts. But from the creative, professional creative, they don't understand. They don't understand the difference between a director and a director of photography, the DP. Completely different things. They just see you have director in your title. Oh, wow, you're this. So to me, Simon, the long-winded answer is that professional creativity, to what it takes to be professional creative, is to understand where you are in your journey and understand what are those skill sets at this particular aspect of my journey that I should focus in on and build and grow and cultivate and constantly nurture and then thrive in that space. And then as you move to the next tier, you add to that. But at the same time, as you're adding to it, you're also recognizing where you don't need to repeat things and you refine it. So you're actually subtracting. You know, really, really weird connection analogy here. As you know, I practice martial arts and I teach martial arts. There's a really quirky saying that we all share, is that, you know, we as professional martial artists and as trained professionals, we in our academy, we don't have belts that you would recognize that says, oh, this is a white belt, they're a junior, and this is a black belt, they're a senior. We actually don't have belts. And you know how we can tell each other's proficiency? By how efficiently somebody moves. They talk less, they move faster, they use less motion. That's how you can tell an experienced professional.
The art of reduction.
Yes, refinement, reduce to build. And the analogy I'll bring back to us is when you learn that, build, 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 but don't build for the sake of building. Because if you build too much, you don't know what your arsenal is. And back to the analogy of the martial arts, we have this really quirky thing that we say, we don't fear the person who can do 1,000 different kicks once. We fear the person who can do one kick 1,000 times because they have mastered that one kick and they know exactly what situation to leverage it. And in a way, that's as professional creatives, you go into a space where you can be multidisciplinary, but there is a core set of where you can build your reputation equity. There's a core set of fundamental strengths that you have as a creative that people will always associate with you and celebrate that. And as you jump into the career, if you want to be multifaceted, but at the same time, recognize when that multifaceted has to be honed in and refined. You come into the business as a general practitioner doctor, and then eventually you become a heart surgeon. That's a specialty. But you had to know this basis to be able to get to there. 10-minute answer to the idea of what it means to be a professional creative.
Very, very, very insightful. I think especially for those who are leaving art school, embarking on a career, and also for those of us who have been in our career for many years. So thank you. Really appreciate your time again, Ricardo.
Of course.
For giving us your knowledge, those golden nuggets, as I would say. I look forward to many more conversations with you. And perhaps as, you know, this series develops, there'll be other moments that we can actually collaborate and have another conversation. So I appreciate it.
Of course. Be an honor. Thank you, Simon.
Thank you.
It's been fun.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Object, Subject, Form. Your engagement helps build a community of like-minded creatives as we navigate the complexities of our respective creative journeys together. If these stories and topics inspire you throughout the series, I encourage you to subscribe, share, and follow me through the links provided in the episode description.